especially once those colleagues dismissed him. Even when it made no sense to go on, even when it became dangerous, I encouraged him. She paused, falling silent for a moment. Then she continued, I told you before that I encouraged him for the sake of his great work. But that is not true. I was protecting the dream I had of my strong, heroic father. I could not allow him to fail, because I could not allow him to be just another man. Staying, continuing, was my need, not his. I was locked in myself, and therefore he died. Her voice drifted off. Kavanaugh said quietly, That seems unnecessarily harsh, she said sharply. Judgmental? Self-hating? What? He knew better than to speak. To Kavanaugh at that moment, she was impenetrable. Having just imagined that he knew her, he saw that he did not. She was indignant, yes, but with herself. He thought of her wrist, its message of the suicidal ledge from which she'd almost leapt. He wanted to pull her back, indicating the book he tacked, to say, Still, the attitudes here are striking. Abelard says that Jewish law is sufficient for salvation. Yes, she said. That contradicts what he wrote earlier, which my father's critic insisted on. The collationes may come very late, not long before Abelard died, perhaps. You notice that the text is incomplete. No, he said. I hadn't noticed that. You will. Either he did not live to finish it, or scandalized monks destroyed what he wrote. Heresy, he said. She answered, Jews are the first heretics. But not the last, he replied. The recognition was about himself. Heretic. For him, that word had always been tied to a fuse. No more. I see that now, he said. Now? In using that word, he hadn't been aware of its weight. Now was a pivot, and she'd invited him to turn upon it. Since meeting you, he said, hardly breathing, I came here today hoping we could... What? He did not know what to say. Then he did. It was obvious. He said, I am sorry that I intruded on you Monday, when we were on the pier. I was out of bounds. When those toxic words, the goddamn bounds again, snapped from his mouth, he realized how off balance he was. He glanced around. In the chapter house, we tell the truth, isn't that it? They say... He nodded. I came here at lunchtime on purpose, thinking you might take your break with me. I wondered if you too felt like we'd begun a conversation we haven't finished. Instead of answering, she just stood there holding herself, hiding behind her dark eyes. Kavanaugh felt remarkably calm. No matter what happened, he would have all that had passed between them up until now, and he would have it forever. He would have the recognitions and the resolutions and the truth that had changed his life. He would have the recovery he'd begun to make, and he would go ahead with it. He would have all of that no matter what she said or what she thought. But he wanted her to understand that he had it because of her. He said, I know you prefer not to eat at lunchtime, but the park outside is sunny. The paths are sheltered from the wind. It's not so cold. We could take a walk. He lifted the book. A wise man by listening, he said, will be wiser. He grinned. Imagine then how much wiser a dolt will be. He waited for her at the museum entrance, feeling self-conscious in his navy coat, the rakish collar of which he had not turned up. When she appeared a few moments later, she was in her cloak and turban, a get-up that took him back to the gleeful scene among all the fancy people at the SS America, where at first she seemed a different person, almost glamorous, Diana Vreeland. But no, Rachel Vidette was authentic to the bone. Kavanaugh, on the other hand, sensed something of the impostor in himself and hated it. The silence as they walked along the serpentine path was easy. Neither seemed in a hurry to break it. Kavanaugh had slipped the colaciones into the ample pocket of his peacoat. He closed his fingers around the book, and it gave him finally something to say. "What made the difference between the early Abelard and the later?" he asked. "You told me the other day that the key was his suffering. The calamity, is that it?" "In part, sure," Rachel answered. "But, of course, something else, something far more important." "What?" he asked. "Eloise," she said, so simply. A man under the influence of a woman, there was the simplicity. "I think I get that," he said, and he laughed. "I think. Except for him, she was détachée," Rachel said, then added, "unbound." That word again. It hit Kavanaugh that if any two people were ever out of bounds, Eloise and Abelard were. But unbound, as Rachel's use of the French suggested, meant detachment, too. Detachment from everything but each other made the lovers masters of everything else, even faith. Out of bounds was the point. As for Kavanaugh himself, the strangest thing about his unsettled condition was the way in which he had begun to face it expressly in relation to this woman. Yet that she was a woman was not the point. He, too, was a man under the influence of a woman, but differently. She was the entirely unexpected occasion of this reckoning, but was nothing like its cause. How was that? Night after night, shivering in his beach chair on the tar-paper deck of the rectory roof, he had examined this. He was at the mercy of his habitual scrupulosity, yes, but this examination of conscience had been for the sake of a purification. For her. What were his motives? He had taken the celibate life and its disciplines for granted, which, he could admit, had more to do with inhibition than with virtue. He knew what it was to be snagged by the glimpse of a well-turned ankle, the sway of pleated dresses, moist pooling in wide female eyes. But he knew nothing of unleashed erotic impulses. The ready flow of feeling for his patients at the hospital, for the kids he sprang from jail, for rosary sayers at the wake, or for the heavy-hearted mothers who knelt before him at the communion rail, rarely equated to feelings about or for himself. Sublimation, in his case, meant redirection, that's all. That he was almost unacquainted with sexual longing must, of course, have had to do with the vice he'd closed on desire of every sort after Runner Malloy. There it was indeed, vice, not virtue. He knew nothing real of intimacy or its pursuit. His Navy years had scraped him free of naivete, but had ironically reinforced his repression. He was not a man on the make. That was why he saw just then this otherwise inscrutable woman was walking with him along this winding path. Her evident history of troubles had not stopped her from trusting him at least this much. He was relieved to believe that she could. Out of the silence, she said, with the directness he'd learned to expect when the subject was not herself, "How has it been with you, going around your loop?" He laughed, but also he realized that she was inviting him to declare himself. "If not with her, with whom?" He said, "I have come to a big decision. I made a mistake when I was young, when I became a priest. I have decided to undo it." "What does that mean?" she asked. "I am going to leave Good Shepherd. Not immediately, but soon." In these straightforward words, he was laying before her the jumble of his whole life. He had never imagined speaking the words with such equanimity. He said, "I am going to leave the priesthood." She stopped and faced him, her face alive with surprise. "You are such a good priest." He laughed. "How would you know that?" "I know it because already that is what you have been to me." She turned away from him, which at first he misunderstood. But she crossed to a bench before a great overgrown juniper shrub that gave the seat a throne-like aspect. She sat and looked back at him, regally. "We must discuss this," her manner declared. He joined her. Now he did lift the collar of his navy jacket for warmth. She pulled her cloak closed in front of her, hiding her hands, which she clasped on her lap. She faced him. "A big decision," you said. "Are you all right?" "Yes," he answered, "I am fine. I'm not quite at peace with myself, but I'm getting there." He might have added, "That's what brought me here today." "I have never known a priest," she said. "Never heard of a priest stopping." "It's like leaving a marriage, I imagine," he said. "But no one's heartbroken. Perhaps the church, in some way," she said. "The church gets pissed off, then pretends you never existed." "But your people? The parish? Sad, yes, some of them, when they hear. Disappointed. But not for long. And it will only be discussed in whispers. Because of the violation, the shame. I will be a shamed person. But I am not ashamed." He was aware of her taking this in, and he expected her comment, but she said nothing. She looked down at her hands, hidden in the folds of her cloak, as if she could see them. Eventually, she said quietly, "A good priest helps sinners acknowledge their sin. Just now, what I told you about my father's project, how I encouraged him past the point of prudence, how I failed to trust him, that he could be a simple man without heroic work, that I willfully refused to face the truth of our situation. All that was a grievous failure. I have never before spoken of it. I spoke to you." He said, "I understood what you were telling me, how it pained you." She nodded. "You took the trouble to learn what my father saw. You told me he was on to something, something important. You told me that, wanting to relieve my remorse. A good priest does that, too. It does not relieve what I feel, but it reverses a prior verdict." She shrugged. "Anyway, one must reserve despair for what is unforgivable." He said, "I hope you won't think me presumptuous if I say nothing is unforgivable." She smiled thinly. He knew to take her silence as rebuttal. He said, "My friend who reappeared at Good Shepherd last week, and whom you encouraged me to find, is homosexual. I had been blind to that and to much else. When we were young, I loved him, but naively. The church made him its whipping boy. I cooperated in that. I've lived a lie for more than a dozen years. This week, with your help, I began to face that, and many other things have become clear. The church has other whipping boys, which means I do too. Jews, she said calmly. Exactly, he said. I know how outrageous it is to compare anything to what just happened in Europe, what just happened to you. He paused, waiting for her to stop him, lecture him, rebuke him. She sat unmoving, but listening. He continued, The bishop told me the two things have nothing in common, but they do. The whipping. They have the whipping in common. She said, I do not presume to speak of your friend. I have had my say with you, speaking as a Jew. But in other realms, some whipping is deserved. Realms, he asked, like what? Realms of yours? You can tell me more, Rachel, if you like. You can tell me the story. No, I cannot, she said, so simply. Kavanaugh realized only now that he had called her by name. She seemed not to notice. He said, You told me the other day that we are at the mercy of the givens of the past. That's been my question this week. Do you believe that I can change my life? She said, If you tell me you can, I believe it. He said, The priesthood, the ultimate given, is supposed to be for keeps. I will be a pariah to my kind. If my parents were alive, this would kill them. My sisters won't disown me, but they'll never forgive me. Your brother? She asked. Jerry's the only one I've told. I'll start my new life at his tugboat company. Business manager, deckhand, something. He's divorced, so he welcomes me to the Pale. He paused, then added, Do you know what the Pale is? No. It's the part of Ireland that the Protestants control. You'll be a Protestant? No, he said. I'll always be a Catholic, which means I'll always be responsible for what we did. He let the two words hang there, we and did. Obvious. After a long time, Kavanaugh became convinced that their conversation was over. He saw that she was exhausted, emptied. Because of his forcing, she had forced herself to come with him, out of mere politeness. Or was it pity? To have imagined in her any semblance of the wish that had returned him to the cloisters, to her, was not only foolish but selfish and insulting. Yet he could not bring himself to end their time together. The stillness between them was the furthest thing from tranquility. But it went on. At last she said, I was in Drancy, what you would call the camp, for a full year after the liberation. I referred to this, but incompletely. You should understand that I was une femme tendue, a shorn woman. What's that? He asked. It's why we took to wearing this. Without raising her eyes, she touched her turban. The post-war head covering de rigueur, so the baldness would not show. We were the collaboratrice horizontale. Many of us. Our Nazi jailers were replaced by heroes of the French resistance. They took turns with us. As our defilers, the Frenchmen were worse. Punishment, they called it. Although in my case, it was justified. I doubt that, he said. She lifted her eyes and looked at him so sharply that he said, I'm sorry. Only then did he realize what a further defilement cheap courtesy could be. He knew from secrets entrusted to him by bedridden lads at the Navy hospital that a chasm had separated him from the real ravages of the war. That chasm was open here between him and this woman. She had, however, begun to speak to him from her side of that pit, and with her voice not much above a whisper, she continued, "I was released from Drancy by the resistance fighters only when I became pregnant by one of them, a troubled pregnancy. I was sent to the Bon Secours sisters. I lost the child, of course." When she fell silent, Kavanaugh had to rein in the impulse to reach a hand across to her. As if she'd read that in him, she looked away. With her eyes averted now, she resumed. "From the hospital, free, I went at once to Ile Saint-Louis, the neighborhood in Paris where we lived. I went to our apartment. I was like a madwoman. The concierge was still there from before the war, Madame Goudreau. I terrified her. Why not? Once I smashed her statue of the Virgin to the floor, a grotesque act, which to this day I do not regret. Naturally so afraid, she admitted me. Our apartment had been stolen, but the thieving occupant was not there. Madame Boudreau gave me the key and let me go up. The last thing I had done on the day my father was arrested was hide his manuscript, Abelard et Israël, under the floorboards of the closet. I went directly there and threw myself on my knees. Some stranger's clothing and shoes, I pushed it all aside. Already I could hear scurrying noises from below. I knew where to press. The boards came loose, and my father's pages were there, still in their satchel, undisturbed by all, except the rats, whose nest I had disturbed. But then I saw. The leather of the satchel had been chewed away into gray tissue. Reaching for the pages, I found that the rats had shredded the paper, all of it, into millions of fine pieces, and, with urine, into paste. "Dear God, Rachel," Kavanaugh whispered. "Dear God." She said, "I had imagined that with my father's treatise on Abelard I could keep my father alive. That purpose had kept me alive. I was living to retrieve that text into which he had poured himself at the end. I aimed to finish it by correcting any errors his critics had identified. With that work, I was going to repair my terrible mistake. When I saw what the rats had done, an utter obliteration, that was the end. C'est tout. My father dead. His Abelard dead. Because of me. That is when..." She uncuffed her sleeve to display her wrist. She ran her forefinger across the scar gently, but still retracing the slice of the blade. What had been Kavanaugh's imposition on Monday was now her act of trust. She said, "Madame Boudreau found me after I cut myself. She did me one great service. Through everything until then, for 3 years, I had clutched my father's small copy of the Historia. That book was all I had of him. It was on the floor beside me. She put it on the stretcher when the police took me away." "Do you have it with you now?" he asked. "No," she said, "which surprises me. Since I shared it with you, I have not felt the same compulsion to carry it everywhere." She shrugged. "I never imagined telling any of this to anyone." He said, "Givens of the past. They never go away, but you change what they mean by putting them into words, all of them." She said, "There are no words for all of them." The worst remains unsaid and always will. What could be worse? He asked quietly. Once again, a sharp, cutting look. She said, Is that a confessor's question? No, he answered firmly. Nor is this confession. Yet her rebuke jolted Kavanaugh, and he was shocked by what came to mind then. She had trusted him because he was a priest, and yet to himself already, he was a priest no more, just your average knucklehead who had glided past what she had told him. The words that Abelard gave the Jew to say returned to him. Indeed, there is no people which has ever been known or even believed to have suffered so much. But were Jews nothing more than that? A people whose eternal fate is to endure, was that her point, the source of her resentment? Morally, yes, there was something worse than victimhood, worse than being slain, surely, was to be a slayer. But that moral horror, he was certain, could not have belonged to her. Kavanaugh was not sitting beside a victim or a slayer, beside a people or even a Jew. He was sitting beside a rare and precious person, a woman. He realized only now that he had used her name again, Rachel, as he had shortly before. By what right had he done that? She misread the cloud that had come over him. She met his eyes with her own to say, with a note of apology, Not confession, no, of course not, not at all. And I was wrong in what I said before. It is not your being a good priest that drew me to you. What drew me, despite myself, to say this much, to say too much, is your simple human kindness. But there is not enough kindness in the world for what remains unsaid. He heard her as if she were speaking, say, to a fellow traveler on a train, someone in whom to confide precisely because he would never be seen again. She fastened the button at her wrist and said, I should get back. Adieu. A week ago, he had imagined them at a threshold together, but they were on its opposite sides. She had not said au revoir. He heard her firm statement as what it was, the closing of the door. Chapter 21 Eloise went round and round, up the spiraling stone shaft to the small chamber beneath the belfry proper, a space to which sentries were dispatched at word of marauders in the region. But to her, the perch high above the cloister served far more often as her personal anchorite cell, a locating refuge to which she had regularly repaired across 8 years of life at the Paraclete. What drew her was not the view of the monastery's surrounding dominion, distant forests and nearby fields bisected by the meandering stream, so much as the mesmerizing point above the tree line in an undefined middle distance, the realm of contemplation. Levitating here in detached solitude, she could be who she truly was. But today, detachment was unthinkable. She'd come here simply to be alone again with the text that had been brought to her 3 days before, surreptitiously delivered by a seneschal from the royal palace in Paris. She'd carried the scroll under her arm as she mounted the stairs. Now she sat on the plain wooden stool, looking out. The stout bell above her was silent. At the mercy of an inchoate dread, she hesitated to unfurl the message once more and reread the foul words. Instead, she took in the view, A closer survey of the Paraclete's demesne. The stream, swollen by spring rains, was high. In the fields it watered, the monastery's men were harrowing the rough-plowed soil and sowing the April barley seed. The sun was bright and the air was mild. The soothing mantle of Eastertide had settled on the world, but not on her. She focused on the drover's road that ran along the ridgeline from which the fields fell away on two sides. On that road, Abbey livestock were regularly driven from one pasture to another, and periodically harvest crops were carted off to market in Nogent-sur-Seine. Pilgrims appeared on the road occasionally, come to venerate the relics of Saint Angilbert, which Charlemagne's daughter Theodred had entrusted to Argenteuil, and which were now housed in the golden reliquary beside the tabernacle in the chapel below. All persons coming to the Paraclete had to pass on that road, and on that road, 2 days before, she'd sent her messenger riding off to the river for the barge to Paris, carrying the urgent summons to Peter Abelard. Now she expected him to appear at any moment, riding in the horse cart she had posted for him at the river landing stage. She unfurled the scroll and read, "He has defiled the church. He has infected with his own blight the minds of simple people." She had to stop. Whose mind was simpler, Eloise wondered, than the young fool to whom this brutal indictment of Peter Abelard was addressed, King Louis VII. 18 years old, he was on the throne less than 2 years, and already wholly at the mercy of the wily white monk, the letter's author. The young king's authority was being tested by burghers in Toulouse, Poitiers, and Bourges. Dukes and counts were poised to take advantage of a weakened sovereign, with the strongest challenge coming already from Theobald, Count of Blois. Bernard of Clairvaux had convinced King Louis that religious dissent fed the roots of political discord, and the taproot of such dissent was Peter Abelard, who was known, after all, to be a favorite of Theobald's. Bernard's solution to the king's great problem was to scour his realm clean of heresy, and the insecure monarch embraced it. Bernard of Clairvaux was Louis's ferret and his war dog. If Mother Eloise had been secretly provided a copy of the white monk's screed, it was only because the king's even younger wife, Eleanor, daughter of the Duke of Aquitaine, aged 17, was herself enthralled to the mawkish love fables of the much-storied abbess herself. The queen cared nothing for the intricacies of Abelard's theology, only for the legend of his early life as a thwarted lover. Eloise disdained Eleanor's girlish fancy, but thought it harmless, and was prepared to turn it to her own ends. The honorable lady had visited the Paraclete. Upon meeting the Mother Abbess, Queen Eleanor had been struck by her unfaded beauty, which was, if anything, made more alluring by being clothed in chastity. The queen had happily accepted the invitation of Mother Eloise to become the abbey's principal patroness. The nun steeled herself to read on. "He tries to explore with his reason what the devout mind grasps at once with vigorous faith. Faith believes, it does not dispute. But this man, apparently holding God suspect, will not believe anything until he has first examined it with his reason." Eloise had to smile. At least that accusation was true. But Bernard's purpose was deadly. His letter to the king proposed the launching of a campaign, a rank attempt to undermine the resounding prestige Peter Abelard had reclaimed for himself in Paris. Peter's new school at Mont-Saint-Geneviève, on the hilly left bank of the Seine, loomed fittingly above Notre Dame, from which he was still banished. If Bernard could simply by this philippic discredit Abelard, then the young scholars who were flocking to him again would not acquire the church-sanctioned bachelor's license recently made necessary to become a master. Bernard's mischief threatened, at the very least, the survival of Abelard's school. But Eloise sensed that more than mere rivalry fueled the white monk's assault. The interdiction was ad hominem in the extreme. His venomous books do not lie peacefully on bookshelves. No, they are read at crossroads. His books have wings. He fills cities and castles with darkness instead of light, with poison instead of honey, or rather, with poison in honey. And how? By undermining the very principle of religious, and therefore social, order, extending beyond the Kingdom of France. More than King Louis VII's standing was at stake. Bernard was warning of a threat to the universal cohesion that the Church herself had only recently reclaimed after the disastrous papal schism, when a pair of manic popes had excommunicated each other. Innocent II's hold on power, after his triumph over Anacletus II, was still fragile, which meant all of Christendom was fragile. A new gospel is being forged for peoples and for nations, a new faith is being propounded, and a new foundation is being laid. Peter Abelard is a man who does not know his limitations, making void the virtue of the cross by the cleverness of his words. The cross. There it was. Yes, Abelard was making void all that was claimed for the cross as the emblem of what a violent father required of his only beloved son. If one person of the Trinity could so ordain the torture of another, imagine what the divine threesome could do to the exiled brood of Adam and Eve. Peter's argument was simplicity itself. Reason tells us that a loving God cannot be cruel. Therefore, cruelty in the name of God, whether in this life or in the life to come, cannot be holy. The cross, cruelty itself, cannot have been willed by God as the mode of God's redemption. Any theology that says so is wrong. The virtue of the cross is not only void, but a lie. What a spacious faith he had. How she loved him. The passion of her youth had never cooled, really. But it had, in these recent years, mellowed into an abiding and affectionate respect. Since he had returned 6 years ago from his hinterland self-exile at Saint-Gilles-de-Rouilly to re-engage the great disputes of the Paris-centered scholars, he had carried himself with an equanimity of which he had known nothing in his youth. He had learned to do without antagonism. That was so even as, in the sacred arena of contention, he continued to dispel the obfuscations known as holy mystery with simple common sense. The God of love loves, that is all. Abelard's poise in the face of disputation now was a matter of self-acceptance. Loves him. Even more than before, Abelard said what he thought because he thought it. He no longer courted magnification of himself in the gaze of his young charges, nor sought he the approval of his rivals. He had her approval, and he knew it. Apparently for him that was enough. Hers, she dared believe, was the sacrament of love that graced him. As the ecclesiastical patron of the Paraclete, Peter made 2 apostolic visitations to her convent a year, and formal though those canonical encounters were, to her They were enough. He was her sacrament, too. The sun had dropped in the sky, and just as she began to think the day would end with his not having come, a horse and cart rounded the farthest turn of the road. One of the two riders wore the black habit of a Benedictine monk. The horse was running at a three-beat gait, less than the gallop of Eloise's heart. She let the parchment snap back into its cylinder, and gathering the skirts of her habit, threw herself into the narrow shaft and down the winding stairs. By the time she reached the monastery gate, the cart was there. The groom leapt down from its bench and took in hand the bridle of the horse. But Peter Abelard was slow to dismount, which was the first suggestion of the difference in him. The second was the slight tremble in his hand as he lifted his personal satchel, the leather pouch that would have carried his books, candles, tablet, and hard biscuits. He used his second hand to steady the first as he handed the bag to the groom. When he turned to Eloise, she noticed at once that he was slightly but uncharacteristically stooped. Though his habit cloaked his frame, she saw in his face that, since he'd last been here months before, he had shed weight. Time had been striking him hard for 60 years, and he looked it. When their eyes met, though, his expression of plain relief at the sight of her could not have been more familiar. He bowed to her and said, "Holy Mother." She laughed. "Holy" had become his way of teasing her, for in her letters she always insisted on, nay, reveled in, her unworthiness, and he knew how she detested the title Mother when it came from him. She bent her knees slightly, one invisible foot in front of the other, and said, "Salutations, Peter Abelard. Welcome home, dear man." To herself, she added, "Husband." Unknown to him, beneath her scapular, her hand went to her breast for the feel of his gold ring hidden there. She pressed it against her flesh for the sweet pain. They remained still, smiling at each other, a pose that stood in for the embrace that was forbidden. The bell for Vespers rang just then, which Eloise welcomed, though she meant to ignore the summons. If she left the rote chanting of the holy office to her sisters, she and Abelard would have the cloister garden to themselves. She led the way there. The setting sun left the quad in shadow, but the air was warm still, and the day's fading was a poignant caress. She had not imagined that anything would come before questions of Bernard's indicting letter, yet she had noticed, in addition to his tremulous hand and slouching posture, a slight shuffle in his step. She gestured with the scroll, pointing at the hand with which he adjusted his habit as he sat on the bench beside her. "Is that a tremble I see in your hand?" she asked. He looked at his hand. "It is nothing, a small pain in the nerves. I have unguent for it. Why have you summoned me? Your message said dire. What trouble?" She unscrolled the parchment and read, "Concerning certain heresies of Peter Abelard. This is correspondence from Bernard of Clairvaux to King Louis. The white monk dangerously slanders you." Abelard nodded, then recited from memory, "He has infected with his own blight the minds of simple people." Abelard shook his head, but calmly. "I have read what Bernard wrote. He sent the same allegations to the Pope and to the Archbishops of Sens, Reims, and Paris as well. So much chaff to the wind. The infecting blight, it says, is Abelard himself." She slapped the parchment. "This marks Bernard's long-plotted offensive against you." "But is it slander?" he asked. "Most of what he writes is true." "He calls it heresy, coming from him, the king's confidant. That is dangerous if it goes unanswered. How do you have it? The queen has confidants too. I am one. She is enchanted with the rosewater legend of our youth. Eloise smiled. Naturally, she assumes my interest in what concerns you. Her nervous husband showed her the letter. She had it copied. She sent it to me. He said, I mistook your summons. I came so promptly because I thought you had other news, more pressing news by far than intrigues of the craven Cistercian. What could be more pressing, she asked. Something that threatens not the reputation of one poor monk, but the moral spine of all Christendom. Have you heard the news from Mainz? No. On Holy Friday last, after the solemnities of the Lord's Passion in the cathedral, there was a massacre in the Talmudic Academy, situated not far away. Having venerated the cross, devout Catholic worshippers stormed out of the cathedral to avenge the murder of the Lord Christ. Hundreds of the so-called Christ killers were slain. It is said that many others threw themselves into the Rhine, together with their children. Jews, all Jews. Hundreds? Eloise asked, not breathing. He said, Isaac Ben Joseph Benvenisti. Prince Isaac? Yes. It is said that he stood at the gate of the Vicus Judaeorum, barring the way. He was the first to fall before the mob. Oh, Peter. Words failed her. When she saw that he had nothing to add, she said quietly, such a thing happened in Mainz before. Yes, he said. Pope Urban's War, then too, preaching on the day of the Lord's Passion, lit the flame. Now a new War of the Cross is being summoned, and preachers are calling again for the killing of Jews. Christ's cross must be avenged. God wills it. Peter was speaking more mournfully than bitterly. After a pause, he added, it was not only that the rabbi saved my life. He was my great teacher. He was my friend. She said, I never saw you hand yourself over to anyone as you did to him, not even to me, your wife. Abelard nodded. To her surprise, he reached his hand to hers and rested two fingers on her one. His hand weighed nothing. He said softly, after Canon Fulbert's men finished with me, I had no choice but to give myself to Prince Isaac. With you, it had been a choice in every way. But like you, the rabbi received me. I deeply grieve his death. As a man of the church, I share the culpability which compounds the grief. Dear Eloise, I had to come to you with this anguish. I cannot bear it alone. This is why I am here. She put the scroll aside to cover his hand with hers. They sat like that, hands joined in her lap, in silence. It was Eloise who spoke first. She took up the scroll again. Bernard is the great war preacher now. Queen Eleanor wrote to me, describing his sermons. O mighty soldiers, O men of war, you have a cause in which to conquer is glorious, and for which to die is gain. Abelard said, he puffs himself up with such blood hosannas. To knights and rabble both, he promises the papal plenary indulgence a sure road to heaven. The cross, once again, is on battle flags in churches. No doubt it was in the Mainz Cathedral. Eloise said, I have a letter from the Queen, in which she says Her husband has had his armor tunic marked with the cross. She mocks him for strutting about the palace wearing it. But then she tells of her own intention to accompany him to Jerusalem. For this holy pilgrimage, she requests our monastic prayers. The nun forced a derisive burst of breath through her nose. That the royals love his great new escapade enhances Bernard's standing everywhere. I did not see this before, but that is why he is moving now against you. She gestured sharply with the scroll. And of course his charge indicts you for making void the virtue of the cross. Bernard's cross is a weapon. The God you are preaching, Peter, is not a God who wills such a war. His appreciative smile pleased her, but when he nodded, it was with a jerking motion. He said, "You are indomitable." "But what will you do?" she asked. "Do? The man spews his filth. My enemies will suck on it. My friends will know what it is." "No. He twists the mind of the king against you. The prelates are one thing, but the king can hurt you," she said. Indeed, the king was already moving against Abelard's patron, Count Theobald, and he was tilting toward Bernard's Cistercian monks against the black robes of Cluny. Because of Italian intrigues, the Pope stood sorely in need of the French king, and so Louis could hurt Abelard in Rome, too. Eloise added, "And Bernard's preaching rises to a pitch before the rabble. The executioner of heretics is the mob, Peter. The man is a danger, I say. You must challenge Bernard." Peter said, "In my youth, I challenged the fox that dared to cross my path in the forest. I challenged the sun not to rise. I challenged the bells of Notre Dame to be silent." She said, "When you challenged philosophers, you won. It made your reputation. More to the point, it vindicated your thinking." "My reputation stands, Eloise. I think what I think, I say so, and I let my words defend themselves. So far they have." "Are you a heretic?" she asked. Her question surprised both of them. "No, absolutely not," he said forcefully. "The measure of my thought is nothing but the gospel, elevated by reason, which is the true mind of the church." "Then show it," she said. "Bernard must be stopped. His manipulation of the boy king must be stopped. His assault on Cluny must be stopped. His war of the cross must be stopped. You can stop him. He has made himself vulnerable to you." Abelard laughed. "How so, mother?" "Do not mother me, Peter Abelard." "How so, then?" "He has defamed you with the charge of heresy. Make him prove it. Demand a hearing. It is your right. He has involved the king and the pope. Therefore, demand a church council. The bishops gathered with universal authority. The king presiding with papal license. Dispute the white monk in that setting. And when you demolish his charges, the anathema will come down on him, not you. The serpent will be defanged." He said, "I went through a heresy trial once before. That was a long time ago, and it was because of me. You were being tried, no matter the pretext, because they hated your proven capacity for love. Now I am an aged abbess, forever cloaked in gray, the color of death. The comely Eloise lives on only in the songs of troubadours, which no one takes seriously. At issue against Bernard will be nothing but ideas and doctrines. Finally, The disputation will shape the future of the faith. It will avenge Prince Isaac. I seek vengeance no more, Abelard said, his voice muted. As for the slaughter of Prince Isaac, I doubt that Bernard, for all his venom, is one of those preaching death to Jews. Perhaps not, but his theology makes such preaching inevitable. Is this why you summoned me? He asked. To stiffen my spine for the melee? To make me young again, but without the comely Eloise? Ah, sir, but you do have her. She covered his hand once more. Our secret. She still knew how to read him, and knew that he had accepted what she'd proposed. He welcomed it. He would be her champion, and she would be his unknown lady. He would vanquish his enemy and live. That, in combination with their physical touch, however bare, should have made her pleasure exquisite. But in his hand, she felt his tremor. Chapter 22 Good Shepherd Church at midnight mass on Christmas Eve was crowded. Along the side aisles, car-sized radiators hissed plumes of steam, and up the length of the center aisle a river of undulating linoleum floor tile shone with festal polish. The stained glass windows, usually so vivid in the daylight, were opaque now. The darkness outside blanked out the colorful saints and martyrs whose peaked hands, tilted heads, and halos were evident only in outlines of lead. The organ was playing a sing-song Silent Night, and the congregation was quietly trilling along, even as latecomers shook out their heavy coats and timidly sought places in the packed pews or in the rearmost corners to stand. The large church seemed small with this turnout, though the willful gestures of its architecture, embedded half-pillars instead of true columns, groined arches made of plaster, chandeliers blazing with flame-pointed light bulbs, fell short of the great Gothic spaces of the Catholic past. The sweeping power of the place came from the overflowing devotion of the mass-goers. They were here because on this night above all others, more than longing for good news, they had it. Michael Cavanaugh faced the congregation from the altar, and his heart brimmed with love for each of them, and for all of them together. If human life is made for more than itself, that more was present not in the sacrament or in the church, but in the good people themselves. And what else, he wondered as he stood with hands steepled at his chin, does Christmas celebrate than that? Hic incarnatus est. God is here, now. Not in that newborn babe, but in us. He was wearing the jubilant gold vestments that the sacristan broke out only once a year, tonight. Behind him stood altar boys, candle-bearers, acolytes, a crucifer, and a thurifer, whose brass incense pot spewed forth a billowing cloud that had everyone in the sanctuary squinting. Beside him were Frank Russell and Billy Mitchell, decked out in the vestments of deacon and subdeacon. Cavanaugh was glad they were there with him. Old fuddy-duddies both, yet he was in touch with how fond he'd become of them, especially Billy, whose glass eye always seemed to be weeping but never was. Billy and Frank had no idea that this was to be his last mass as a priest. Without knowing it, they were stand-ins for the entire fraternity from which he would walk away tonight. When they exchanged the ritual kiss of peace, he would bid adieu, through them, to all the brothers of the common life. In this one instance, perhaps, He would let the war-wounded Billy's tears be a sign of actual feeling. What most surprised Kavanaugh was the equanimity with which he'd come to